Hi, friends. I appreciate all of you who are listening to Real Grief, Real Healing, the podcast. If you're finding benefit from listening to anything that I might have to say or my guests, what they are sharing, the importance of all of the aspects of how they have had grief and how they are healing, my experiences that I share, how I have had grief and do have grief and also am healing. What I'm asking you to do is please share this on social media, because right now that is how I will build more people to be listening. And one of the reasons I want to build more people to be listening is I want to continue helping people like you. I get messages from several of you on a weekly basis. And if you like what you're hearing and you think someone else can benefit, please share on your social media channels. I would sure appreciate it. Thank you.
Welcome to Real Grief, Real Healing with Mindy Corcoran here on the Experience of the Soul podcast channel, taking a deep dive into the reality of the difficulty grief brings and offering insight into the healing available to each of us. Today, episode 33, Our Teen in Crisis. And now your host, Mindy Corcoran.
Hi, friends. This is Mindy Corcoran. Thank you for joining me with Real Grief, Real Healing with Mindy Corcoran. I am holding in my hands Healing a Shattered Soul, the memoir that I published on May 3rd. It had a birthday. Books have a birthday. I don't know if you know that or not, but as a new author, I learned that books have a birthday. And the birthday of Healing a Shattered Soul is May 3rd, 2021. And so we're right now a month out of that. It's been a journey. It was a journey before I wrote it, and now it's continuing to be a journey. I want to bring to your attention that in my book, if you have not had it, if you've not had it in your hands or seen it, I certainly hope that you do take time to purchase one and get your hands on it. And the reason I say that is I am looking at page. Let me see what page it is, because it's 227, 226. I'm looking at page 226 and 227. And the reason I wasn't quite sure what page it was on is because there's a photo on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, it says chapter 22, part one, Our Teen in Crisis. There were no page numbers on those when I was glancing down at them. I'm bringing this up because on the left-hand side, the photograph is of my youngest son, Lucas Lowson, and it's a photograph of him riding on a casket. It's a very solemn photo. There are no humans behind him. The seats behind him are empty. The funeral was over. And he's riding on the casket of my father, who he called Popeye. The inscription below the photograph, I wrote the inscription for every photo. I wrote all the inscriptions. And this one says, Lucas leaving a message for his Popeye. I'm very thankful to Joe Shalmoni. He's the photojournalist that took several of the photos that are placed throughout the book, throughout the memoir. And so I mention this because, you know, it may be your intention to buy the book and you're going to buy the Kindle. And I just want you to know that's totally fine. Buy it however you want to buy it. Purchase it however you want to purchase it. I think that's fantastic to get a healing mechanism in your hands. But it is a beautiful book as well. And so much heart and soul was put into this. And this is just one photograph that is so meaningful to me. Behind Lucas, you'll see a TV screen. It's down on the ground, and it's showing a slideshow that was during the funeral. So it's just, this photograph itself has so much in it, all at one time. I hope that you get the opportunity to see that photo in the book. What I plan to do now is I'm going to move forward in this conversation with you, and I'm going to read the chapter titled Part One, Our Teen in Crisis. On November 28th, 2020, my 18-year-old son, Lucas Lowson tells me during an interview for my December Real Grief, Real Healing with Mindy Corporan podcast, major grief events, major life events that happen definitely can alter you, but it's also all about how you handle it. It's all about how you take it, and it's a lot on the people around you. You really see who your friends are when stuff like that happens. If you have the right people around you, then you can get over it quicker. If you have the wrong people around you, you may never even move forward, and you always have to have support. I've had a really good support system, so I was able to get over it. Immediately, I had mixed emotions. Oh, baby, I want to interrupt him and say, you will never get over it. But these are the words he used. They are not my words. This is Lucas's story, not mine. My heart began to overflow with love, mixed with a familiar sadness as I heard him use the words, if you have the right people around you. In the Overland Park Regional Medical Center emergency room on April 13, 2014, Rabbi Jonathan Rudnick found Lucas. Both Chronos and Kairos unfolded. He was the only youth there in a room full of people. He was there, yet he was alone, alone in the middle of adult chaos, the rabbi shared with me. The ancient Greeks had two words for time, Chronos and Kairos. The former refers to chronological time, while the latter focuses on time as an opportune moment. The tick, tick, ticking of the clock sped up like a Bugatti Veyron Supersport, the fastest car in the world. I'm told it can go from 0 to 60 in 2.4 seconds. As a Kansas City Chiefs football fan, I am familiar with wide receiver Tyreek Hill, who can run the 40-yard dash in 4.29 seconds. Considering these two examples hopefully makes your heart race and aligns you closely to how we felt after hearing that Reet, Lucas's older brother by 2 years and 10 months, had also not survived. The unimaginable had just been spoken. Lucas remembers his childhood babysitter, Laura Carley, being at the hospital. Laura and her father, Richard, my business partner in Boyer Corporan Wealth Management, enveloped Lucas during the most vulnerable time in his life. We had not only lost Lucas's grandfather to a violent murder, we had also now lost Reet, his only sibling. Within hours, other family friends became part of a tribe caring for Lucas. They basically took care of me for the next few days, along with tons of friends, my mom's clients too, and the Women Who Mean Business, this fabulous organization that my mom was involved in. I mean, oh my goodness. It seemed as if 60 women were at our house every day just begging to take a preteen to lunch and dinner. Everyone took care of me for the next few days. Regarding April 13th in particular, Lucas shares, I remember we wound up at my grandma's at some point. The head pastor of the church that we go to showed up. He was there talking to us, which I always thought was a really big deal because he is a really big deal. He showed up to talk to us, like, who were we to him? We are actually really good friends with him, though, which is pretty cool. And that's honestly all that I remember of that day. Only a few days after Reet and Dad were murdered, Lucas desperately wanted a few items from his school locker. Part of our family's caring tribe, our friend Kathy Shikovitz, drove him to school. This was the conversation she recalled. One of my most vivid memories was helping Lucas. He really wanted to get his University of Oklahoma hoodie out of his locker at school. As we drove up to the school, he said to me, my brother was always the popular one and so confident. I was looking forward to being at the same school with him. I don't know what I'll do without him. Walking into the school, Lucas's friends and other students were quick to surround him in hugs. Everyone in the school now knew who Lucas was. Trauma can do a number on our brain chemistry and functioning. We can appear extremely operational, and yet our brains are truly uninhabited for a period of time. Everyone's time in trauma triage differs. Lucas was loved and well-liked from the beginning of school. The traumatic murders, coupled with fear, layered self-doubt and skepticism on his now fragile state of mind. There used to be information I knew, and now there were blank spaces or holes in the messaging. For a period of time, I lost the ability to compute mathematical equations, even simple addition and subtraction problems. This proved to be frustrating, considering I was the CEO of a wealth management firm. In the week following the beautiful funeral for my father and Reet, I am sitting at our kitchen counter desperately pleading for the world to just stop. Please stand still. I don't think I can muster the strength to keep moving with you, is written in one of many journal entries in late April 2014. It is as if we have been placed in a pool of thick molasses and expected to walk normally through the same syrupy, heavy muck. I don't want to move, which of course makes moving in any direction all that much more difficult. Now, while in that pool of molasses, we need to figure out how to parent a 12-year-old who has just lost his brother and grandfather to murder by gunfire. Hopelessness comes to mind. Where will I find hope during this tumultuous storm of life? Parenting is a tough job. Parenting after losing a child feels close to impossible. Learning to breathe on my own was only one step in thousands I had to take while I was parenting a hurting 12-year-old who had to be experiencing the same anguish. Losing my father and Reet was painful. Parenting Lucas after their deaths had its own layered complications. The conversation at hand is about Lucas. Len voices his desire for us to find our new normal. He feels Lucas's normal is going back to school. My brain fog is heavy during those conversations about going back to school or staying home. Len had been watching me cry through each day, meandering from one room to the next, like a ghost. He didn't want Lucas staying home to see more of this. Nor did he want Lucas holed up in his game room, drowning himself with car chases and scoring touchdowns on his favorite video games. I wasn't sharing my insecurity in parenting with anyone at this time. My own guilt and shame were just that, my own. Settling in my gut was the reality that Dad and Reet were at the Jewish Community Center because of my planning. I scheduled the audition for April 13th. It was me who chose the 1:30 p.m. audition slot. The turmoil inside my body was excruciating and not shared with anyone for over a year. Having little mental strength or resolve, I agreed to send Lucas back to his sixth grade classes at Blue Valley Middle School. As a preteen, Lucas didn't know how to manage the myriad of emotions that had been thrust upon him. While we had involved Lucas in Little League baseball, lacrosse, flag football, and scouting, we had not previously signed him up for Grief 101 or how to cope with significant loss. There was no question that Lucas was so broken and sad that he could have benefited from staying at home, snuggled next to me, watching a movie or two. Lynn believed school and his friends there might be the key to Lucas beginning to resume life as a normal kid. This sounds plausible. This sounds like good parenting, and it places Lucas in someone else's care for several hours each day. Those someones were not as broken as his mom, who needed some space to collect herself. In the evenings, Lucas worked to pull us together the best way he knew how, through comedy. He wanted all three of us to sit together and watch movies, but only comedies. He demanded only comedies because he was searching for our laughs. I am careful not to tell him that a smile was difficult for me to find, let alone a laugh. However, after sitting through pretty much every Will Ferrell movie together, it dawns on me that this is Lucas's path for personal healing. And he is helping to ease the pain for all three of us through laughter. His unconscious intuition is insightful. Still wrestling with the deep fear that accompanies losing a child, I am seeking a physical connection with Lucas. The shooting robbed me of parenting Myrit. His life, taken in such a rapid and dramatic way, I was left breathless, aching and desperately longing for more time to be his mom. This reality has caused me to want every moment with Lucas to constitute quality time. I want to connect with him through closeness, snuggles, reading together, talking about anything, and experiencing new memories together. Lucas wants none of this, at least from me. He had always gravitated towards Lynn, and this attraction to and desire for his dad's attention is noticeably increasing. During this same time in our lives, our male friends provided a caring hedge of protection around Lynn. They were well-meaning as they picked him up in the early evenings for dinner and drinking. I expect Lynn had shared with them the misery I portrayed daily at our kitchen table, reading one sympathy card after another until I reached 14 cards each day. Because we received hundreds of cards, this pushing through grief process went on for weeks. I can imagine he was looking for an escape. The escape came with red wine and late nights. While I so appreciated their loyalty and support for Lynn, I worried about how often he was numbing his sadness with alcohol. Again, having barely the strength for myself and placing Lucas second only to my basic physical needs, there was no complaining from me to Lynn about his chosen path for grieving. During the daytime, we slowly drifted into our own rooms of the home, outlining physically that we had chosen different paths for grieving the loss of our child. Reed had been my person, and I had been his. It was typical when the four of us went anywhere that Reed sat next to me and Lucas sat next to Lynn. There was hardly a question when we boarded a carnival ride as to who would sit with whom. Dinner tables found us doing the same. However, any time we flew on an airplane, I got both boys while Lynn sat in his own row. Was it only because Reed shared my hazel eyes and dimples that we were so close? No. My heart aches recalling the depth of our relationship and that of mine with my father and my father with Reed. We were each other's person, no questions asked. Now, with Lucas seeking Lynn's attention over mine and Lynn finding solace with friends, wine, and Lucas in return, I am alone in my own home, even when we are all there. We breathe a sigh of relief when school let out for summer, only weeks after the murders and funeral of two family members we should not have lost. The final weeks of Lucas's sixth grade year were a non-event for his brain. He showed up only physically, which for the time being, we and his teachers were agreeable to. Somehow, the summer months made their way through our calendar without us noticing much. We did leave our home for the July 4th weekend to see the cousins, Kim, John, Hayden, Brandon, and Jaja Harrison at their lake home near Dallas. Lynn basically packed our bags and gave us the date and time of departure. Lucas was more than willing to leave our sorrowful home, but unwilling to prepare himself in any way. I, on the other hand, allowed fear and a new trepidation of meeting people who didn't know our story to convince me that I could live in our home and stay in our community of people we knew for the foreseeable future. The first panic attack I recall ever having in my life occurred as I buckled my seatbelt to leave our home for another state, knowing that the reason Reed wasn't with us had nothing to do with him being at summer camp. He was dead. As quickly as I could, the buckle came off and I shouted to Lynn and Lucas as I jumped out of the car, "I have to get something." Having no idea what I might be retrieving from our home, I was up the stairs and in Reed's bedroom, frantically looking for something to give me solace before my own brain could surmise what my heart was leading us to. Lucas needed to leave our home for a while. Lynn demanded we leave our home and drive to Texas. Frightened of this new reality of living with just the three of us, or the two of them and me, I stopped in the middle of my boy's bedroom and stood still. Reet, I am so sorry. We are leaving for Texas without you. I am so sorry, honey. Please help me with this. Could you please help me take the next step? And then my eyes settled on a stuffed doll on Reet's bed. It was a doll from a popular cartoon that Reet watched. He had won the doll at an amusement park when he was with his dad, Gary. Grabbing the doll quickly, running back down the stairs, and remembering to reset our alarm and lock our doors, my mind is noticeably clearer. Lucas watches me curiously while I buckle this doll into the back seat next to him. "Stewie!" Lucas says out loud. "So that's what you needed to get? Stewie?" he asks. Now, realizing the doll has a name, I go with it and act as normal as possible. I responded, "Well, yes, I think it will be help us all if Stewie takes this trip with us since Reet can't be here." Lynn says nothing during my entire escape and return. I buckle up, and as we drive away from our home, I know the pain will follow me, but somehow I know Reet, and perhaps Dad, are with me too. Here is what I realized in 2020 as I was finalizing this paragraph about Stewie needing to come with us on this particular trip. Stewie's full fictional name is Stewie Griffin. I didn't know this until I confirmed how to spell his first name. Yes, the name of the doll. Reet's name is Reet Griffin. This is but one of over 1,000 messages or God winks I've received since April 13th, 2014. The first day of Lucas's 7th grade, which should have marked the beginning of Reet's sophomore year, sends me into a deep depression. I didn't realize how difficult it would be to watch Lucas walk into school and not have the opportunity to watch Reet do the same. Caught completely off guard by the unexpected depth of grief that accompanied me that day after dropping Lucas off at his middle school, my car seemed to drive itself to our friend's home. Jerry and Josh, who were my drivers to and from the vigil on the night of the murders, have provided steadfast support throughout the past several months. They welcomed me in and allowed me to sob as I desperately pleaded to have my son back. I know my unplanned visit is causing them to be late to work, but there is no mention of it. They sit with me as the pain pulses through my body. I'm familiar with this painful process of grief by now. The panic arrives initially and then followed by a fear that I can't place. My heart rate increases quickly, as if struggling to keep up with my frantic, racing thoughts. Breathing becomes difficult and gasping for air is common. My soul is shattered and ripped apart, and I have no choice but to break down in tears. Somehow, each river of tears paves a path for calm. Crying and then laughing through several camping memories that come to mind of Reet, Jerry, and Josh help this particular episode find an ending. The sorrow will continue, but the panic and fear have subsided. Because crying is still a daily ritual for me, I notice Lucas's lack of tears. He doesn't cry much anymore, and I start to worry that he is shutting down emotionally in order to avoid the pain of grief. On the outside, he appears to be fine, which is exactly how I tend to appear. Six and a half years into this journey, I know that the outside is a farce. Knowing what is going on inside is key. It's crucial to our survival. In August 2014, we received a warning, a red flag, about how Lucas was processing his grief. At about the exact same time, 1 year prior, with Reet and Lucas in tow, we were visiting the George W. Bush Presidential Center on the Southern Methodist University campus in Dallas, Texas, when Lucas doubled over in enough pain that we rushed him to Children's Medical Center of Dallas. We suspected an angry appendix causing the problem, but a CT scan found Lucas had an obstructed bowel. He was in surgery within an hour. Lucas and I spent 3 nights under great care, and when he was released, Lynn and Reed had decided our summer trip was over, and we drove home. Now, his mention of severe stomach pain takes the three of us to Children's Mercy Hospital in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. My journal notes from August 26, 2014 read, "Yesterday, Lucas had severe stomach pains like he did last summer. Lynn took him to the Children's Mercy ER. His urine and blood were normal, and they processed a CAT scan. This scan revealed swollen or enlarged lymph nodes on the opposite side of where he's feeling the pain. Due to his previous colon obstruction surgery, Lucas was admitted for observation. The doctors were considering a colonoscopy, but also were waiting for fluids and a special cocktail to rally his bowels into action. When a long-awaited bowel movement arrived, we were released with instructions for him to take Miralax as a daily regimen. My journal notes continue on August 29th. Lucas made it through the entire day of school! Thankfully, Lucas's teachers are supportive and patient with him as he becomes a daily fixture in the office of his school counselor, Candy Moore. And our dear friend and his principal, Roxana Rogers Lemon, welcomes Lucas into her office at any time with no questions asked. Lucas manages to spend more time with Candy and Roxana than in the classroom. Lucas is not unruly. He has just decided not to be in class often, or at all. Engaged only in seventh grade football after quitting lacrosse and scouting, Lucas floats through school. My grieving process was to busy myself and pull others along with me. In late September, I joined my two friends, Kathy and Lori, for a sprint triathlon in Lost Pines, Texas. In early October, my mother accompanied me to a speaking presentation in front of the Kansas City Medical Society. And late October found us spending money with wild abandon on tickets to attend several of the Kansas City Royals' home games as they marched through the World Series playoffs against the San Francisco Giants. In between these two experiences, we were honored in Washington, D.C. by the Anti-Defamation League at their 20th annual In Concert Against Hate. It was a marvelous trip. My mother, her sister, my aunt, Barbara Fox, a large gathering of the Lamano family, my cousin Cecilia Pruitt and her husband Will Knuckles. They all attended. Dear friends Shirley Doyle and Sharon and Mike Davis, who have played key roles in our lives and in this memoir, were able to share with us in the magnitude of tragedy and celebration of life that was captured in song, prose, and music. The event itself was fabulous and heart-wrenching at the same time. My ability to live through memories, the stories of April 13th, and all the details has always presented differently than any other family members. I can only surmise this to be so because I found Dad and Reed in the parking lot. Feeling as if I was with them when they lost their lives, I have placed a responsibility on myself to carry their story to others for purposes of clarity and education. In doing so, and perhaps as often as I share the details of their murders, I can speak to the story without seeming as though it causes too much distress. As our story was being told in song and prose, Lucas became quite upset. I had hoped he would see the value in their story being told to this audience and forgot that his 12-year-old mind might shut down based on the trauma inflicted upon him. Lucas was rescued by Cecilia as she leaned into our row, offering to take him out of the auditorium for a walk. Having Dad, Reed, and Terry honored along with our families meant a great deal to us. We were thankful for the opportunity to meet other honorees such as Jacqueline Mirakatete, founder of the nonprofit Genocide Survivors Foundation. At the age of 9, she lost her entire immediate family and most of her extended family in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. She has since become a lawyer, married, and is a mother of 2. Meeting Jacqueline and her husband was a highlight for us all, especially Lucas. We were in need of something or someone to help him engage in any planned activity. JB, Jacqueline's husband, was fond of Lucas. Over dinner, I could see Lucas coming out of his angered stance and opening up to their personal story. Lucas had lost his grandfather and brother, a horrible tragedy. He now listened to Jacqueline and JB tell of all the people they lost during the Rwandan genocide. Incomprehensible. Knowing he was not alone in grieving his own family members, Lucas connected with both of them immediately. From the White House to the Crime and Punishment Museum, which now looks humorous in the same sentence, Lucas complained with each step. Hungry every hour, he would not allow anything to satisfy or calm him. He quieted only when we walked into the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, almost as if the angels in the room summoned him to do so. Lucas raced through the museum with little interest, and we lost track of him for about 20 minutes. It was when he appeared in front of me, with red cheeks and tears flowing down them, that I focused on the pain inside his heart, the pain he refused to mention. Lucas had found the exhibit displaying the shoes of the victims. Grabbing me by the hand, he pulled me past exhibits I had yet to see and placed me in front of the shoe exhibit. "Were they all killed for the same reason as Popeye and Reet?" he whispered. Finally, a discussion about their deaths presented itself. Our arguing about where and what to eat and about which is the next museum or tour all came to a stop. We sat on the floor next to the shoes and talked about how Popeye and Reet were murdered for similar reasons as the people who were murdered in the Holocaust. As thankful as I was for the honor from the Anti-Defamation League and all the pomp and circumstance for Dad and Reet, I could not have known Lucas needed to see the Holocaust victims' shoes to break open the shell he had built around himself. Thanksgiving brought on another panic attack for me. Fearful of sitting down to our Thanksgiving meal without the two of them, I explained over the phone to my sweet sister-in-law, Dana, Tony's wife, that Reet and Dad each needed a seat at the table. Hearing my anxiety and caring for me deeply, they created a table setting complete with a photo including both of our loved ones. They died together and would sit together at Thanksgiving, too. We only made it through Christmas because seemingly the rest of society as we knew it forced us through each damned stinking day. Honored to carry Christ's light for one of the Church of the Resurrection Christmas Eve services, Len carried the candle leading Lucas, Yeye, Tony, Dana, Andrew, Katie, and me down a dark path through a significant portion of the congregants attending and up onto a darkened stage. Mind you, this is the exact same location of the funeral held 8 months prior. Christ's light is the only light in the entire space filled with 3,200 people seeking hope, inspiration, and peace this holiday season. Our broken family, chosen to represent that survival from the unthinkable can be obtained. Physically, we look the part. Christ's light is used to light what is called the Advent wreath, symbolizing the passage of the 4 weeks of Advent. Christ's light is then used to light 1, 2, 3, or more candles in turn. Each of these candles light the same number. Within only minutes, we can see faces glowing in the seats near the stage as Christ's light is now beaming back at us from 3,200 gleaming candles. Our pastors and those in attendance may have thought we were there to show them what hope and inspiration look like. Each one of us, tearful and aching, with now an all too familiar pain, were filled from their light, Christ's light. From the stage, we could see hope and inspiration in front of us, beaming with love to continue with us on our journey. As we rounded into 2015, my relationship with Lucas was shifting in alarming ways. He was becoming more combative. Quick to anger and verbally lash out at a target, he chose me as his mark. When he wasn't watching a funny movie, it was easy for him to become enraged. Lucas was also gaining weight quickly, and had grown taller than me. I still had the upper hand, but only because of my confidence as an adult. Lucas never hit me, nor did he make any attempts to do so. However, I feared his ability to take an action that he could not take back if we didn't find a way to soothe his temper. In and out of what seemed like a dozen or more local counseling sessions, Lucas was diagnosed with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Still, he wanted nothing to do with processing his anger or grief in a formal, traditional manner. While we didn't believe he was all right, this is how he described himself after slamming more than a few doors in my face. A new version of fear came to fruition when we received a call from Candy Moore, the Blue Valley Middle School counselor, in late February of 2015. My world suddenly stopped all over again. Candy explained to me over the phone that Lucas had confided in a friend that he was contemplating suicide over the weekend. His friend told her mother, who then called Candy. A feeling of disbelief washed over me. I feel like I was taken out at the knees again. At the moment, it reminded me of how I felt when I arrived at the parking lot of the Jewish Community Center when I found my father and Reet. I am in a panic with seemingly less control of my life, and obviously, none of Lucas's. Friends, I'm going to stop there. That's not the end of the chapter. There are another two or three pages. I want you to know that the path that anyone takes after a journey from trauma, the path is not linear. It has zigs and zags. It has mountains and it has crevices, deep, deep crevices and high, high mountains. I don't know where you are with your pain right now. I don't know if you have any pain or you have significant pain. And I don't know where you are on your journey. I will tell you, though, that I want you to have hope. Have hope that you can find the right path for you. I do pray that healing a shattered soul is helpful to you and so many other people. I might add, really, a shameless plug, if you like my book, please leave a review. As a new author, I'm learning that I have to ask for reviews as often as we hear and get surveys on email. And I'm laughing because I'm one of those people who tries to answer those surveys on behalf of anyone that sends me one. I'm a helper. Please be a helper to me too. Write a review on Goodreads or write a review on Amazon or post that you like and appreciate the value of hope and inspiration that I've offered to you in healing a shattered soul. Thank you for joining me today on Real Grief, Real Healing with Mindy Corcoran.
Thank you for listening to Real Grief, Real Healing here on the Experience of the Soul podcast channel. This channel is made possible because of listeners just like you. If you would like to support the channel with your tax-deductible contribution on an ongoing basis or through a one-time gift, head over to experienceofthesoul.com/support. Real Grief, Real Healing is copyright 2021, Mindy Corcoran, all rights reserved. Our theme music is composed by Dave Croft and used with permission. The Experience of the Soul podcast channel is a production of 818 Studios.